Welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Mickey Badlamenti, discipleship pastor here at Rock Point Community Church. Our goal in the messages we share is to consistently present God's truth in ways that will challenge you, bring you new perspective, and ultimately lead you into closer relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Wherever you're listening from, we hope this message encourages you in your faith. We also welcome you to visit us anytime you're in the Detroit area. Our Sunday services are at 9 and 11 a.m. and include a full range of children's programs, as well as a ministry specifically for children with special needs. Find us on Facebook or visit our website at rockpoint.org for more information.
We are blessed. We are entering into a season here of about 5 or 6 weeks before we enter a whole new season of ministry that will begin the second week of September with a single service at 11 o'clock. What's what we call homecoming in our fall launch. And to that end, we now have a series of speakers that are dear and trusted friends that they're practically adjunct staff members at this point in time. We're going to have some extremes in this process. For example, we begin today with Alicia Wood, who is 5'5", and we will end with Abdu Murray, who is 6'8". All right? Alicia comes to us. She's been grew up in the New York area, but she's also has a lot of history in Detroit, having gone to college here and has relatives and family here. She has degrees in both social justice as well as criminal justice. She is an outstanding violin player, actually recently on an album that's being produced at Christmas time for the Collingswood family. She's played with Mickey last time she was here. She's an amateur hockey player and one of the most brilliant young minds that I've encountered. Someone who I have a great, deep appreciation for. Please welcome closely and well, my dear friend, Alicia Wood.
Thank you. Oh, well, good morning. I shared with the first service, by the way. Let's just be real. This is the service I would wake up for. So you guys are totally my people, right? I'm totally like the 11 a.m. crowd. Yeah, how late can I sleep in, right? That's totally me. So good to see you all, my 11 o'clock crowd. But usually, as many of you know, I play violin in the orchestra at my church on Sunday mornings. And we occasionally, maybe every couple weeks or so, will play like a intro song that's just the orchestra, just like an instrumental for the congregation. And the one we were going to do today was And Can It Be? And I was so bummed to have missed it. And then I was sitting there and all of a sudden Dean starts playing And Can It Be? And I'm like, Lord, you snuck it in for me. Thank you. You know? So that was really, really cool to be able to hear. I always love coming in and worshiping with you all. And thank you, Randy, of course, as well, for always giving the opportunity to come back. And I feel like I come back and I know so many people, you know? It's like, oh, good, Alicia, good to see you. How is this one? Or how are you doing? And we catch up and things like that. So it's always fun to come back and talk with you guys. Today, I have a interesting topic that is called revenge or redemption, and looking at maybe our natural tendencies as people and as humans versus what is it that God has called us to do? What is it that he desires of us? And so I want to kind of challenge us and me included as we think about these topics. When things go wrong, how do we process? Do we do what maybe might feel good, the revengeful way, or do we do something that might be a little bit unlike our normal nature? And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, but there's no better way, of course, to talk about redemption or these kind of things than to first look at the topic of forgiveness. You have to start there. And when I look at forgiveness, I go to Jesus and I say, okay, well, who did he forgive? Well, he forgave Peter, even though Peter denied him and turned his back on him. He forgave the woman who was caught in the act of adultery. And even though she was fully in her sin, right, he recognized that you were a sinner, but he forgave. So he forgives the sinner. But he also forgave his enemy. He also forgave his enemy, the people who put him on the cross. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And it's this forgiving the enemy piece that I think is so important to us as Christians. So what does it mean to forgive our enemy? Well, let me just kind of talk a little about forgiveness for a second. Forgiveness essentially is a heart posture. You're releasing from bondage or wrongdoing somebody who has sinned against you. And so you choose to let those wrongs go as if they've never even been committed in the first place. When the Bible looks at forgiveness, it encourages this idea of removing and releasing, letting go, abandoning, as if the wrongs and sins are departing and leaving you behind. That's how the Bible talks about that. So I need to always make the point, though, because I think we often think, but if I forgive, then that means that they don't have to suffer the consequences. That's not what forgiveness means. And I'll explain that a little bit more later on. But I want to make sure that we understand clearly that forgiveness doesn't say, oh, there's not going to be a punishment and consequences don't matter. They do, and they should still happen. But forgiveness is dealing with how are we looking at the person. So you may be somebody here that struggles to forgive, and I get that. Maybe it's because the other person, what they did, it just seems so bad. Maybe because you are just so hurt deeply and meaningfully by whatever it is that they did. Or maybe it's because you're somebody who just struggles with the bitterness, struggles with the wounds that you can't seem to let go. So whatever the reason, you're not alone. But I think Jesus can be helpful to us here. And so we're going to look at a passage in Luke 18. And what I love about this passage is it's a parable that Jesus is telling. And he starts it off by telling people, saying that this is a parable of people who are confident in their record of doing good things. And as a result, they look down on everybody else. Like Jesus was so slick, you know? And so he's going to compare in this parable two different groups of people. Number one is the tax collector. Now, the reason why the tax collector is a crook is because unlike today, guys, we didn't have all these official IRS documents and printing up your W-2s and all this kind of stuff, right? The tax collector said, you owe $100. So you paid the $100. The truth was you owed $90 and they were pocketing the other 10. That's how tax collectors worked. So people didn't like them. They were dishonest. Matthew was a tax collector. Then you also have a Pharisee. Now, the Pharisee, you would think, I mean, this is the opposite end of the tax collector, right? These are the morally upright people. These are your good people. So Jesus is going to compare the two. And so let's go ahead and read what he says here in Luke 18. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Very interesting introduction. I think that's very profound. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven. But he beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. And so the Pharisee prayed, God, thank you. I'm not like the other people who rob and kill and commit adultery or crooks like this tax collector. But I fast twice a week. I give my money. Look at how morally good and morally superior I am. Thank you. I'm not like him. Here we have a man by whom all criteria in that modern era would seem like they are the good person. They are morally righteous, morally good. But what happened in his pompous attitude is he missed several things. Number one, he missed the pride in his own heart and the hatred and disdain he had for somebody else who he perceived wasn't as good as him. But also the Bible tells us that there's none righteous, no, not one. Not a single one. So that's why Jesus' introduction to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else is so profound. He's trying to put us all in check here, guys. Meanwhile, the tax collector, fully noticing his failures, can't even look to God. He is so covered in shame, beating his chest in anguish because he's so upset with who he is. But yet, only one of those two walked away in right standing before God. So there's a few things we can learn from this parable. Number one, all sins can be forgiven, except, of course, as the Bible tells us, the sin of blasphemy, which is lying about Holy Spirit, insulting, discrediting God, these kind of things. Lying, insulting, discrediting God, and basically denying him who he is. You're not God. Jesus isn't God. You're not the creator, whatever it might be. It's ultimately what people go to hell for, this idea of like just complete rejection of God. So we know from this parable that all sins, even that dirty, nasty tax collector and his evil deeds, can be found forgiven. Number two, One of the reasons we don't forgive is because we think of the other person as not like us. They've done so bad that it makes sense that I wouldn't forgive them. Guys, I hate to tell you, but a lot of times we think that the Pharisees kind of stopped existing after the New Testament. I hate to tell you that they're alive and well. In me, in you. We oftentimes struggle to forgive because we say, but look at how undeserving. That person always messes up. That person is always doing bad things. They're not like me. So therefore, that justifies why I wouldn't forgive them. And the third thing that that we can take away from the story is following on those same lines. What the Pharisee did in order to determine his goodness was to compare himself to the tax collector. So we make that same mistake. I hear people say to me all the time that aren't Christians, I would say, you know, if you die, what would happen? Oh, I'm going to go to heaven. Really? How do you know you're going to go to heaven? Because I'm a good person. Oh. Well, how have you determined that you are good? What we often do as humans is we compare ourselves to other people. And we say, in comparison to them, I'm better, therefore I'm good. And we use other people as our moral standard. They are our moral measuring line. I'm not like the person in prison, therefore I'm good and they're bad. That's our distinction. Guys, the problem is we are not the standard through which we determine each other's morality. Amen. The standard is God himself. Moral perfection. And then when we compare ourselves to him, man, we realize we are all the tax collector. That is the common mistake that we make. Jesus is the standard of goodness, not us. And one thing I've learned in my experience in life is that those who are quickest to forgive are those who have fallen in the hole themselves. And they know what it's like to be down there and alone and ashamed and disappointed in yourself, wondering how they're going to get out. Sometimes somebody climbs down and helps them come out. Other times they're able to get out on their own. But that's the person that's quick to forgive the next person that falls in the hole because they know what it's like to be down there. Guys, we are all in these holes. We are all broken at the foot of the cross, looking up. Of no power of our own can we be good to God. And so sometimes we need to realize that the enemy is actually us. The tax collector is us. In a familiar conversation between Jesus and Peter, Jesus is asked about forgiveness. This is in Matthew 18, so read along with me here. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to seven times? Jesus answered, I tell you, not seven times, but 77 times. There's a couple things worth noting here. Let me give you a little bit of a background. There was some rabbinical tradition where the rabbis were trying to wrestle, how many times is it that we actually are required to forgive somebody before we can just say, we're not going to forgive them anymore, or we can just hold a grudge against them? So they wanted to know, you know, they wanted to know all the rules, and they wanted to know the number. And so this is a little bit of the background behind Peter. So what's the number? Like, how many times is it before you're like, okay, you can't be forgiven? And so Jesus' response is 77 times. Now, your text might say 77, or your text might say 70 times 7, and it might have a little note, because scholars aren't quite sure if it's 77 or 70 times 7, which way to interpret that. So a lot of times the Bible will have a little note there saying it could go either way. Well, interestingly enough, there's an Old Testament scholar named Chad Bird, and he thinks that the correct interpretation of this is indeed 77 times. And the reason why he thinks this is because of an interesting passage back in Genesis chapter 4. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. So Lamech kills somebody, a young man, for hurting him, wounding him, injuring him, and he has avenged himself 77 times. Guys, remember that the Jews are steeped in the Old Testament. And so while Lamech talks about 77 times, as 77 times that my vengeance will be carried out, my vengeance is essentially unlimited, well, according to this Old Testament scholar, he would say that Jesus is making that comparison. And he's saying, well, you say your vengeance is unlimited. I'm saying 77 times my forgiveness is unlimited. And he is taking that vengeance mindset and flipping it upside down. That's why we forgive those who wrong us. We forgive because God has forgiven us for a plethora of sins. I bet if you were to think through your life, you might discover maybe there's more than 77 wrongs that you've done. Maybe you needed not 77 times, maybe you needed 700 times. I'm sure I'm past the 77th mark. And so when we hear things like Stephen, or we hear phrases like Stephen said when he was being stoned, Lord, don't hold this sin against them. He's not denying that they're doing something wrong. It's a grave injustice. He does not deserve it. But he is, so you are seeing a reflection of his heart posture as somebody who's been forgiven much, wanting to offer forgiveness to the sinner, even though they haven't even asked for it. Problem is, in our culture, guys, forgiveness is so uncool. That's how we end up with cancel culture, where your life is defined by the worst thing you ever did. Even if you did something wrong 16 years ago, you can't be redeemed, you can't be new, you can't be changed. This is who you always are. So forgiveness is so unpopular in our culture, and it's easy for us to be influenced by that. But that's not the way of the Christian. And one of the things that makes forgiveness so hard is that we are so scared to forgive because then we think we're letting somebody go of facing the consequence for what they've done. But let me correct that now. Number one, forgiveness does not mean that people do not still end up in prison or go through a criminal system for something that they've done wrong. I'm a criminal justice major. I'm very much a proponent of the criminal justice system. It's got its failures, but it also has its goods. And I'm thankful for that. So forgiveness doesn't mean, hey, we're not going to let something go through the court system. Remember, forgiveness is about your heart posture. But there's plenty of things that happen in our lives where it has nothing to do with that. Where it's somebody gossiped about us, somebody slandered us, somebody insulted us, somebody just hurt us emotionally or mentally, stuff that would never go to the criminal courts. And we struggle to forgive those things. And if I forgive, well, they're going to think it's okay to do that. Guys, nobody escapes justice. The judge of all the earth will do right. He will always do right. What you don't want to do is ever pray, God, get him. Girl, I can't wait to see what you do. In fact, maybe some of you have this experience where somebody's wronged you, and then fast forward, you know, a couple years, whatever it might be, and you see something really tragic happen to them, and you actually feel bad for them. You know, and so there's a sense in which we don't want to pray, God do, God do, God do. We don't want to do that. But we also don't want to think that God doesn't do. But the reason why I spent this time on forgiveness is because forgiveness is so important in order for us to love our enemy. You cannot love your enemy if you do not forgive your enemy. Well, why do you say that, Alicia? Because it's almost as if God thought we might be confused about what love meant in 2026, so he devoted an entire chapter to it in 1 Corinthians 13. And what it tells us about love is it says love is patient, it's kind, it doesn't envy, it doesn't boast, it's not proud, it doesn't dishonor others, it's not self-seeking, it's not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs. So in order to love our enemy, we must keep no record of wrongs. Listen to Jesus' words right here. Soon. There it is. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you all get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Man, Christianity sure is fun, isn't it? Oh my goodness. Take a look at this part that I underlined in this particular text. It says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Guys, people often say to me, religion, Christianity, these are all just psychological crutches that people need to get through life because they're not very emotionally strong or they're not very mentally well. And so they need something to help them get through and help their emotions and all these kind of things. Guys, that is not easy. That is not a psychological crutch. Loving your enemies and praying for those who persecute you, how does that make me feel better? That when people say that stuff to me, I'm like, you clearly haven't read the text. Because the text challenges us and calls us to behaviors that are very difficult, laying down your desires, picking up your cross, loving the enemy. So God calls us to a standard that's contrary to our human nature, the human nature that we saw the tax collectors follow as they were nasty to people and stealing from people. But what's also interesting is for many years, I read this section wrong on the sun and the rain. I read it like an American living in modern era, which I always have to catch myself doing, but it just makes its way in there sometimes. I don't always catch it. And I remember reading this and being like, okay, so the sun rises on the evil and good. Okay, so good things happen to the evil and good to evil people and good people. Okay. And then the rain falls on the righteous and unrighteous. Okay, so bad things happen to righteous and righteous, right? Righteous and unrighteous, right? Sun is good and beautiful. We do all these kind of activities. And the rain is gloomy and dark and causes traffic jams. And we can't go outside and it makes us cancel our activities and things like this. So this is, they're saying good things happen to evil and good people and bad things happen to evil and good people. And then somebody brought to my attention, Alicia, when is rain ever not good in the Middle East? And I was like, oh yeah, the Bible wasn't written today. It was written in the Middle East. They need the rain. And I began to realize this is saying good things happen to evil and good people. And the rain is also good things happening to the righteous and unrighteous. In other words, God brings good to both groups of people, the righteous and the unrighteous. In other words, guys, even the bad, even the unrighteous get good things from God. So loving our enemy and not demanding revenge is a command straight from Jesus himself. And while I agree it's completely countercultural, it actually does work. Take a look at this next picture. This next picture is a picture of the school building where in 2006, a gentleman named Charles Roberts, who was a local milk truck driver, walked into this Amish school building and shot 10 children before killing himself. 5 of them died, 5 survived. In response to the shooting, that very same day, the Amish went and visited Charles's widow and their 3 small children. Their mindset was, she too has lost somebody today. In the days following, they donated money to the widow and her children. And if that wasn't enough, they actually went to Charles Roberts' funeral service. So at the same time they're burying their children, they went to the funeral service of the man who took their lives. And in one final act of forgiveness, they even hugged and embraced Charles's widow and members of his family while at the funeral service. I can't say whether or not the Amish are Christian or not. Some people have all kind of different views and perspectives on are they Christian or not Christian. I'm not even going to get into that today. But it is interesting reading the aftermath and what people said. Listen to what this particular Reverend Robert Schenck, what he said in the aftermath of the school shooting when he was being interviewed. He says that he was at the scene, and while he was standing next to the, he was at the scene, he was relaying a story of a grandfather, of what a grandfather was saying to some other kids. And he's saying, as the grandfather was standing next to the body of this 13-year-old girl, this grandfather was tutoring the young boys. He was making a point, just saying to the family, we must not think evil of this man. And this Reverend Robert Schenck said it was one of the most touching things that he's ever seen in 25 years of Christian ministry. He was being interviewed on CNN. I remember this story. And the person who first told me about this story was a non-Christian friend of mine. And I remember it was in the days following the shooting, she said, "Did you hear what's going on with them?" I'm like, "Yeah, I heard about the shooting and it's horrible and tragic." She goes, "No." She's like, "The family members went and visited his funeral. They went to his wife." She was so blown away by the love and compassion that the Amish showed towards the man who had wounded them so deeply. She was not a Christian. Guys, sometimes loving our enemy isn't about us. It's about who's watching us. And 20 years later, I still remember my conversation with her, and I still remember this story. Sometimes it isn't about you, but there's always somebody watching to see how will you respond. I recently heard the story of, and it came out of Australia, of a couple named Danny and Layla Abdullah. And this is one of the most profound examples of loving your enemy that I've ever read. What you're about to see here is a picture of a tombstone in the faces of four children. In 2020, so just not too long ago, his name is Samuel Davidson, but Sam, at the age of 29, was driving with a blood alcohol level of 0.15%. He had picked up alcohol when his older sister suddenly died, and he just didn't know how to deal with the grief and the pain. For whatever reason, he got in his car that day, and he started driving. Took a corner too quickly, end up going over the curb and hit seven children who were walking to the store to get ice cream. Four of them died. A fifth was left with serious traumatic brain injury. But three of these four were in the same family, which means their parents, Danny and Layla, lost three children in one day. Not long after this, Layla started wearing a shirt that said Team Jesus. And just days after she lost her three kids, she got on national TV in Australia and says that she forgives Sam. She says, if Jesus can forgive, we have to forgive. Danny says that he forgives him too. And Sam was sentenced to 20 some odd years in prison. And Dan wasn't enough for Danny. He started visiting Sam in prison, the man who had taken the lives of his three children. And he told Sam that he forgave him. When Sam realized that Danny forgave him, he just cried, he said. He says, being forgiven has given him hope, and that he'd be in such a place of darkness if he hadn't been forgiven. Sam now looks to Danny as his godfather, and he wants to be just like him. Danny's response is, what has happened has happened. And what's the point of me still being angry, still hating him? What will it accomplish? In our culture, we spend a lot of time yelling and hating each other and pointing fingers at each other and mocking people all because we hate people and we don't care about showing love. We don't care about any of that. We think all of our hatred is love, but it's not. We call it love. But where's it gotten us? If it was love, then it would unify us. It would bring us closer together. We'd feel better. Instead, we're more divisive and divided and tension and anger. Clearly, it's not love. We feel justified in hating. We feel justified in digging up people's failures. But what would it look like if we loved our enemy as a culture? What if we forgave even if we couldn't make things right again? Well, Sam's parents were so touched by Danny's love for their son. They have now attended the 5-year anniversary last year of the death of these young children. And as a result of Danny's relationship with Sam, Sam is now a Christian. He has now been baptized. His life has been changed. You can watch the story of Danny and Layla Abdullah on YouTube. And when I did, I began to read just through some of the comments. What are people saying about this? So let me read you some of the comments that were just on this YouTube video. One person said, a driver cut me off earlier today, and I reacted angrily, beeped my horn, and cursed at him. And here's this man who has wholly forgiven somebody for the worst thing that could ever happen. He's taught me a valuable lesson. Another person said, Danny did save Sam. He couldn't save his kids, but he saved Sam. That's beautiful. Another one said, I'm almost 20 and I've been on YouTube for an overwhelming majority of my life. This video right here may be the most incredible thing I've watched. And one other person said, I'm a 40-year-old man on the other side of the world in Sweden. And I'm sitting here and crying my eyes out. What a touching, sad, but also beautiful documentary. Are we keeping in mind who is watching us as we love our enemy? Sometimes, guys, as painful as God's commands are, he truly knows what's right, not just for us, but for everybody else. You're not the only one he cares about. But you've got people around the world that are influenced by a love. Amidst his tears and agony of losing 3 kids in one day, the love he was able to show towards an enemy and the change that it made in his life. I shared before about what redemption means. And when we're looking at this whole topic of revenge and redemption, we really have to understand what redemption means. And like so many things in the Bible, there is an Old Testament understanding of what redemption means. In the Old Testament, the way the family household was structured is you had a father and his wife, and they had their kids. When the kids grew up, the girls would get married and move into the household of their husbands. And the boys would grow up, stay in the father's household, and their wives would leave their households and come in. So you have the father and his wife, and then their 3 adult children, let's say 3 adult sons, let's say, and their 3 adult wives, okay? And they would all live in this big family compound. And then when the father died, the eldest son would replace him, and you know, he would have kids, and the cycle just kind of continues on like that. But the father, who was the head of that, it's called the Bet Ab in Hebrew, this household, had a lot of responsibility for everybody in there. He had to make sure that they were all provided for, that there was food, that there was safety. He had to look out for everybody in the household. And if somehow, for some reason, whether because one of his children made a bad arrangement and got into debt, and so they end up getting sold into slavery, or whether they got kidnapped, or whatever it might be, if there's some reason why one of those kids ended up outside of the household, it was the job of the father to pay the debt, to pay the price, to do what he had to do to take that child and bring them back into the household. When you did that, when you brought that child back into the household, that was called redeemed. This is why Jesus is our redeemer. Because the Father looks at all of us who are outside of his household and says, what is the price I need to pay to bring them into my household? And so we are redeemed through Jesus. That is the price that is paid so that we can belong in the household of God, call ourselves brothers and sisters. This picture of the prodigal son, this coming home, being embraced in your filth and in your shame and in your sin, I think captures it so well. Guys, if you knew that if you prayed for your enemy, the person who wronged you, that one day they would become a Christian and bow their knee to Jesus, would you pray for them? Of course you would. So then why don't we actually assume that that's what will happen when we pray for them? Maybe we need to kind of have that approach. We don't know what God will do, so I'm going to pray for you anyways. And if I see somehow that you are coming into the household of God, that somehow you are redeemed, well, glory to God, that's exciting. I don't know if many of you are familiar with the residential schools in Canada. The residential schools were schools run by the Canadian government, the Protestant Church and the Catholic Church, and they were run from the 1800s until about 1996, but I think they mostly had shut down in the 1950s. What they did is they went into the First Nations communities, we would say Native Americans here, they say First Nations there, go into the First Nations community and say, let's bring your kids into our schools, we'll educate them, we'll teach them in the way of the land, this kind of thing. So the First Nations people trusted them, and they brought all these kids into these residential schools. Thing is, when they got there, they cut their hair, stopped letting them speak their own language, wouldn't let them eat any of their own foods, tried to erase their culture from them. And then there's histories of abuses and things. Sometimes girls end up pregnant, and there's all kind of things going on. And so the residential schools became extremely controversial because a lot of this stuff didn't come out into more recent times. And even when the kids tried to go back to their communities, they were so distant from them culturally, they couldn't even really reconnect. Several years ago, I was at the University of Toronto speaking on something, there for several days. And this residential school, all the discoveries they had made about the abuses was a big deal at the time. It was all over the Canadian news cycle. And so one of the nights that I was there, they decided, this group decided to have a dialogue between two First Nations people. One of them was a pastor, and this pastor had actually gone to the residential schools. The other one was a member from the First Nations community. I would say the pastor was probably in his 50s, 60s, and this gentleman was much older, probably late 70s or so. And this gentleman from the First Nations community was very upset about the impact of the residential schools. He would write public articles in the newspaper. He would make public statements. I mean, he was very vocal, and he would go around and speak on all of this stuff. And he was very, very angry over what had happened to his people in the residential schools, understandably. The pastor at the same time would share his story of living in an alcoholic in the First Nations community before going to the residential schools. Thankfully for him, his experience was good in the schools. And it was in this school that he found Jesus. He was able to take Jesus back to his family and actually led his family to Christ. And so he talked a lot about how we need to forgive the sins of the past rather than continue to hold on to them and talk about the sins of the past over and over and over and over and over again, like this gentleman from the First Nations was doing. At nearly 80 years old or whatever he was, he could not stop talking about something that happened years prior. And the pastor said, as a Christian, he has a framework through which he can understand forgiveness. And so here's four things he said. Number one, forgiveness heals and stops the cycle. A soft answer turns away wrath. Number two, forgiveness unconditionally is the key. Number three, forgiveness means the person has no effect on you anymore. As long as you don't forgive each other, you will affect and destroy each other. And number four, if you need restitution in order to forgive, then how can it be unconditional? He forgives without restitution. The other gentleman was listening to this pastor this whole time. And then all of a sudden he stops him. And he's like, you talk about all this forgiveness. All this forgiving this person. He goes, that doesn't even make sense to me. Because in my language, we don't even have a word for forgiveness. You could have heard a pin drop in that place. I'm like, you don't even have the word forgiveness in your language? No wonder you're 70, 80 years old and you're angry and you're bitter. You have no outlet. You have no guidance to tell you what to do with that. In a world where forgiveness isn't popular, thankfully God gives us that word. The Bible story points towards redemption because that's what the Father does for us. We receive forgiveness and we are brought back into the household for many, many, many of our failures. So whatever people have done, the gossip, the lies, the nasty stuff, the emotional hurt, whatever it is, it can be forgiven because it was forgiven of you as well. So free yourself, guys, from holding on to your anger, your bitterness, and your demand that you need to be the one to handle justice. Justice will sometimes be done here, but if it's not, it will happen because the judge of all the earth will always do right, which was Abraham's challenge to God back in the Old Testament. Will not the God of all the earth do right? Absolutely he will. And so therefore, be obedient to the Lord, love your enemy, be quick to forgive so you don't end up like that First Nations man. Clement of Alexandria, the learned Christian teacher in Egypt, once wrote this, and I think this is a great way to end it. Loving one's enemies does not mean loving wickedness, ungodliness, adultery, or theft. Rather, it means loving the thief, the ungodly person, the adulterer. Not as far as he sins in respect of the actions by which he stains the name of man, but as he is a man and is the work of God. There's a reason why God gave us this word. We could never say, I don't have a word for that in my language. In a minute, we're about to have communion. And one of the things that is so good to think about when it comes to communion, of course, is the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. But also, the fact that he did live, die, and rise from the dead, how has that impacted and overhauled your life? Who are you now because of him? And hopefully, you are also a person of forgiveness because you have been forgiven much.